is a war story that goes back to 1944 when I was stationed with the 8th Air Force with the 306 Bomb Group, the 423rd Squadron, and we were at an air base in a little town called Thurlow, England, which was about 30 miles north of London. The date of this story goes back to November 21st in 1944. Our crews were awakened about 3 o'clock in the morning, and we got up and went down to the mess hall for breakfast, and then we headed out to the ready room for the briefing for the mission that day. At the briefing, they told us our target was going to be Merseburg, which was an oil refinery town about 30 miles west of Leipzig, Germany. It was very heavily defended, and when they told us what the target would be, you could hear all the groans that had gone up in the, with all the crews. I had been there on two prior missions, and believe you me, the flak got pretty thick over that target. They were making gasoline out of coal. They had a cracking plant set up there. And, oh, guys, they were making everything you could think of out of coal. They even made margarine out of it. They also made aniline dyes and sulfanilamide, a whole bunch of stuff. But primarily, it was a synthetic oil refinery. Germans were so short of petroleum at that time of the war that maybe they could only put up, say, 30 or 50 or maybe 60 fighter planes a day. And they had, about 5,000 first-class fighter planes on their western front. But due to the shortage of fuel, they could only put up a few, which was fortunate for us. So consequently, we kept hitting these oil refineries. We were assigned to the number 2 position as a deputy group lead. And we had a plane which had a radar in it, as well as the lead plane. The only two planes that had radar in them were the first and second plane. At the pilot's briefing, we were told the altitude to fly and all about the target and alternate target, secondary target, that is, and a whole bunch of stuff which was pertinent to us. The bombardiers, they had their briefing. Navigators had their briefing, separate briefings, and the radio men and all the other crew members had their separate briefings. So then we all got that taken care of, so we went down to the drying room and got our parachutes and all of our gear and hopped on a truck and went out to the plane. We did our pre-flight inspection on the plane, and of course the gunners got their guns and ammunition all loaded up and everything prior to takeoff. All of this pre-flight inspection took about 45 minutes. Wanted to make sure we had a full gas load and all that bit. So we got all loaded up, and of course we had to wait for a certain time when we were given the instructions to start our engines and start to taxi out. Well, we got in our respective positions and taxied out and got out on the runway and got all lined up, and of course we had the second plane to take off. Now with a B-17, well, you get it lined up with the runway, and then you have to lock the tail wheel to keep the thing going straight. And you had to get up a speed of about 60 miles an hour before you had rudder control. So anyway, we were given the signal to take off, so we took off right after the first plane. Got going down the runway a little ways, and all at once, gee whiz, we broke the shear pin on the rudder, which made the plane uncontrollable. It was just like a car on ice, you know. You zig and zag and everything, and we couldn't get it straightened up. And, of course, we didn't have rudder control by that time. So the only thing we could do was to cut the throttles and pull off of the runway to let the rest of the group off. Well, this was kind of a bad start, but anyway, we got all of our gear out of the plane and took it over to an alternate plane, which was on standby. So after the group planes got off, we transferred all of our stuff over to this other plane, got in it, got all loaded up, got it pre-flighted, of course, had to go through all that again. And then we taxied out and we took off and headed out for a rendezvous point where the group had a certain place that they all gathered and circled around, gaining altitude until everybody got lined up and got in their position. Well, fortunately, we were lucky to find our group. Sometimes people couldn't find their group, and so they'd just latch on to another one, and so they wouldn't abort the mission, and not knowing just where in the heck they were going to go. Sometimes, if it was going to be a short mission, they wouldn't have a full fuel load, and they would start out, and they'd get on, hook up with a group that was going for a long, long-range target, and lo and behold, they sometimes would end up running out of gas before they got back to England. But we were fortunate to find our regular group, and we got in position. As we were climbing out over the channel, well, let's see, our altitude was supposed to be at 25,000 feet. And as we were climbing out over the channel, my number three engine started throwing some oil out of the breather cap, which was on top of the nacelle. And this was a sure indication of internal engine failure. Well, we discussed this problem and decided that if we could get our altitude before we lost this engine, that we would go ahead and go on in. Now, the rest of my crew, I was wounded on my 13th mission, and I was laid up for, about 2 months where I couldn't fly. But the rest of my crew kept on flying, and consequently, they got quite a ways ahead of me. Well, some of them were on about their 33rd or 34th mission, which at that time, we had to have 35 missions to complete our tour and get sent back to the States. Originally, it was 25 missions, but then just, about a month or so before I got over to England, why they upped the thing to 35 missions. It's just my luck. But anyway, we decided we'd go ahead and go on in, because some of these crew members were getting pretty close to 35 missions. I think one of them was on the 34th, but they were wanting to get their 35 missions in so they could get home by Christmas, because this was November in 44. Well, the old engine happened to hang in there and kept it running okay, but as we were going into the target, we ran into a real heavy cloud layer where we couldn't go through it and get to the primary target, which is Merseburg, and also we couldn't even get to the secondary target, so the whole mission had to turn around, and we started looking for a target of opportunity, which, like bridges or railroad yards or something like that. As we were kind of roaming around looking for some place to drop our bombs, my group happened to get about a mile off course, I guess, went over a four-gun flak battery near Osnabrück, Germany, and gee whiz, they started tracking us, and that is, they shot in front and then behind and half the difference, and bang, boy, they got us. Their four-gun battery, four guns that hit us. We ended up losing three engines. My bombardier told me later that knocked the right landing gear off. So, anyway, I feathered these three engines, feathered the props on these three. Well, I got hit, too, at that time, and my navigator was hit in the back. But, anyway, we had to leave the formation, and I feathered the three engines, props on three engines, and also hit the fuel cutoff switches. And I did everything I could think of in the cockpit. Well, my leg, when I got hit in the leg, gee whiz, I ended up losing about half of the calf muscle. It felt about like a horse kicking me. And so it was 50 below centigrade in the plane, which is about 60 below Fahrenheit. And my leg was just steaming like a hot steak, and I looked at it. Of course, my pants and flight suit was all ripped open, and I could see that it was a heck of a wound. So I left the cockpit and crawled on down in the catwalk, and I was going to have the bombardier put a bandage on my leg, because I knew he had a first aid kit. What I didn't know was that my navigator was hit in the back, and the bombardier was working on him. So I was in this catwalk underneath the cockpit there. And then my engineer came down and told me that our good engine was on fire and everybody was going to bail out. Well, I was right by the nose escape hatch, which was a small door. So I pulled the emergency release handle, which pulled the pins out of the hinge, and the door just flew off. So here I was on my hands and knees down there on the catwalk. And gee whiz, with my parachute on and all that, I thought, boy, that looks like a pretty small hole to get out. And I was kind of wondering how in the heck I was going to get out of the thing. So I kind of stuck my head out to look. And by that time, it just sucked me right on out of the escape hatch. Well, I kind of rolled and tumbled through the prop hoist there, and then all at once things just kind of calmed down, and I just started falling, and everything was quiet, and, you know, I had no weight there. Well, I knew that going out at 25,000 feet that it was going to take me a long time to hit the ground, because the terminal velocity of a falling body is about 120 miles an hour, which is about 2 miles a minute. And I was up darn near 5 miles, so I knew that I was going to have at least 2 minutes before I was going to have to open my parachute. So on the way down, I thought, gee whiz, I was wondering if I should try to land on both feet or on one, because the rate of descent was about 16 feet per second, which would be about the same speed you would hit the ground if you jumped off of an 8-foot platform, which is a pretty good jolt, come to think of it. And if I thought, well, now if I just try to land on one leg, there's a chance I might break it. So and of course I didn't know if there were bones broken in my injured leg or not. And I thought, well, shucks, I'll go ahead and try to land on both legs anyway. Well, it seemed like I fell for a long, long, long time. Actually, you know, 2 minutes is quite a little while. But on the way down, I remembered the book said, you know, when you open your chute, to check and see if you were drifting any. So I remember the book said to sight between your feet. And sure enough, I was drifting, oh, just a little bit backwards. Oh, I suppose maybe a gentle breeze, maybe a 5-mile-an-hour breeze, something like that. So I did, as the book said, to cross your arms and get a hold of the shroud lines and pull, which would turn you around. So I did that, and I'm a son of a gun if I didn't pull too hard, and I ended up making a complete turn. Well, by this time, I was getting down pretty close to the ground, and I thought, boy, I better not mess with this chute. I don't want to collapse it, which I don't think I would have anyway. But anyway, I was looking where I was going to land. It was out in the country, and I saw some water. It was a peat bog, I guess, kind of an old swampy-like thing, and I suppose the whole thing might have been 20 yards in diameter or something like that, a rather small pool. And I thought I was going to drift over it, but I'm a son of a gun if I didn't land right smack dab in the middle of that thing. Of course, my momentum kind of carried me, and the water splashed up over my face, and of course I had no idea how deep this doggone thing was. Well, actually, there's only about 2 feet of water in it, but I didn't know it at the time. And so here I was struggling trying to get my Mae West life preserver inflated. Now, if you bail out over water, your parachute harness is over the outside of this life preserver. So if you bail out over water, well, you start getting the buckles unhooked so you can get out of the harness and then inflate your life vest. So here I was struggling to get a hold of these these cords, which, there were two CO2 cylinders in this life vest, and we had a cord for each one, which you would pull, and that would puncture the cylinder and inflate that section of the life preserver. So here I was sitting in this water, just trying to get a hold of those doggone things and to inflate, and all at once I realized that water, that I was only in water up about to my armpits, and so I didn't inflate the jacket. But anyway, I got out of the harness and I started to wade out of this pool of water. Oh, it had all kinds of old muck and slime and animal droppings and everything in it. And I had on these heavy flying boots, and gee whiz, as I'd walk across there, why, I'd pull one foot up and the other would go down almost to my knees, and I got to the bank and I couldn't get out of the thing because my feet were stuck in this mud. So I waded back and got a hold of my parachute, dragged it across, and then stepped on the thing and got my feet out of the mud and climbed out on the bank there. I thought, oh boy, Trey, what in the heck are you going to do about this now? I knew I was going to have some medical attention, and I had absolutely no idea what was going to happen. Actually, I was never prepared to be a prisoner of war. I had never even thought about being taken prisoner. And, of course, they didn't tell us much, you know, what to expect, not like the briefings that they have nowadays, and, well, with the survival gear and everything they have now that we didn't have then. But all they told us was that all you have to tell the Germans is your name, rank, and serial number. Well, that's a lot of BS, you know. So, anyway, I was sitting there. And I'd lit about a quarter of a mile from this farmhouse, and I guess this old farmer saw me coming down, so he ran back and got a rifle and came out there, and I saw him coming. And I was sitting there, and I saw him coming, so I hollered at him, wait for me, come on over. So he was kind of cautious. He didn't know if I was going to start shooting at him or what. But anyway, I pointed to the ground, and I said, Deutschland? He said, yeah, yeah, yeah. I said, oh, my God. Actually, we were trying to make it back to our lines. We had a good tailwind, and if we hadn't caught fire, we could have made it back to our lines, because this was after the invasion, and our troops were making a lot of headway. But he hollered at a Frenchman who had been some slave labor, I guess, on his farm, and so they both came over there, and one got on one side, and one got on the other. I kind of hobbled up to his farmhouse. I had absolutely no idea what was going on, because I couldn't speak German and they couldn't speak English. So they put me in this farmhouse had the kitchen, and then there was kind of one section where they had a well, a hand pump, and had a concrete floor, and then the barn. All this was all connected. So they put me in this little well house there and set me down on a chair. And I wasn't bleeding very much, actually. I think probably all the cold and, well, the shell fragment just missed the bone, and it missed the artery, and it missed the nerves. It was just a flesh wound. And I think that cold water probably helped stop the bleeding, because I really didn't bleed very much. A little bit ran down into my shoe. But anyway, I sat there, and they were jabbering away, you know, and they didn't know what the heck to do with me, so finally, after, I guess, about 20, 30 minutes, the Burgermeister came out, who was the mayor of the little village. The little village was called Vecta, V-E-C-T-A, which was in, and I didn't know just where that was until years later when I met my navigator at one of our reunions, and he told me just where it was that we bailed out. But anyway, this mayor, he didn't know what in the heck to do, so they jabbered around for a little while. Pretty soon a couple of soldiers showed up, and so they borrowed a wagon and a team of horses from this farmer, put a little straw in it, and I thought they were going to take me out and shoot me. Well, this old farmer, I happened to have four packages of cigarettes with me, which just fit in the pocket of my flight jacket. Seemed like about every mission there was one of my crew members that was out of cigarettes, and they were trying to bum cigarettes off of me, you know, during the whole mission. And we were rationed to five packages a week, so rather than let them bum cigarettes off me, I just give them a pack of cigarettes and tell them to pay me back when we got back to England, which worked pretty good. Well, anyway, I had these four packages, and I thought, well, doggone it, they're probably going to take these away from me. So I caught this farmer's attention, and I gave him these four packs of cigarettes, which were very valuable at that time, much more so than I realized. Boy, he took those things, and he hid them out in the barn in some straw. So when they loaded me on this wagon, why, the last thing, he slipped me one package of cigarettes back as they got me in this wagon. I thought really then that they were going to take me out of ways and shoot me. I really thought that, and I thought at the time, well, doggone it, they can only kill me once. But we went, I suppose, maybe half mile or maybe a mile somewhere along there, quite a little ways. And we came to this German air base. They pulled this wagon up there. And here all these German airmen, you know, they were eyeballing me, you know. They was kind of curious to see what an American looked like. So they put me in the guardhouse that night. No medical attention or anything. I had some sulfa tablets with me that I carried, and I took those. But anyway, they got me in this guardhouse, and I kind of got dried out. Oh, I was so cold, gee whiz. I was wet clear up to my armpits. And I was so cold, I just shook and shivered, you know, for the longest time. Well, there was a German warrant officer came in, and he could speak English. And heck, we yacked for, way up to the middle of the night, I guess. And I found out more about Germany than he found out about us. But he was a pretty nice guy. He was a pilot. So the next morning, I did get dried out. They took a platoon of men and put me on a stretcher. And six of them got me on their shoulders, and boy, they went marching off, you know, and they were singing these marching songs. And those guys were as careful with me as if I'd been one of their own people. And they, I don't know how far we went. I guess maybe it was, maybe something like a mile or something like that. And we came to a train station, and they put me in the baggage room, still on the stretcher. We were waiting for this train. Well, while we were in this baggage room, I had to go to the toilet. My old bladder was just about to pop. And see, we took off about 8 o'clock that day before, and we got shot down about noon. So it was all that rest of that day around that night, and it was about 10 o'clock the next morning when I had to go to the toilet. Well, they left four guards with me in this train station. So I told them, I says, I have to go to the toilet. I have to tinkle. I had everything that I could think of, you know, to explain to them what. And they couldn't understand. They had my escape kit, and they would take pieces out of it, you know, and I kept shaking my head, and they handed me a match. I said no, and they were just puzzled. So there was a couple of gals in there in the baggage room, or I could maybe have given them a sign language. But finally, there was a civilian came in, and I recognized him, asking if he could speak Americanish. He said, yeah. So I told him what I wanted, and he translated. And these guards, it just like a light bulb going off, you know, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, they were so happy to figure out what in the heck I wanted. So they picked me up, and they marched me down to the men's room. So when we got back, they put me back on the stretcher, and they explained to me that each one of these guards could speak four different languages. One could speak Polish and Russian and something else, and one could speak Spanish and Italian. I don't know, all these different languages. Each one could speak four languages. And here we couldn't communicate on the basic needs of life, and we thought it was kind of funny. Actually, we got a big laugh out of it. Finally, a train came, and we got on the train, and then we got held up with an air raid, and I don't know, one or two other things. And so they were taking me to a hospital, which, of course, I didn't know. And finally, we got to this one little town called Lingen, Germany, which is on the Ems River, at the north end of the Ruhr Valley. It was about 10 o'clock that night when we got there. So they took me up to surgery, and there were two French doctors who had been prisoners nearly 4 years when I got there. So they gave me some ether, put me to sleep, and cleaned my leg up and all the loose pieces and wrapped it up. And of course, all they had was crepe paper for bandages, and put some sulfa powder in it, and took me to a room and put me in the bed. Now this bed was kind of a makeshift thing. It had no springs in it, and the mattress cover was just a burlap bag, like a gunny sack, and it had excelsior in it, wood excelsior. And oh boy, it was just lumpy as could be. But anyway, it was warm in the hospital. There were a whole bunch of prisoners in there, and of course they wanted to know where I was from and all this and that. Actually, I knew more about what was going on in the war when I became a prisoner than I did when I was flying combat, because we would interrogate all the new prisoners, find out what outfit they were from and where the front was and how the war was going. We had very little to eat there, and of course we got some Red Cross parcels, which I had no idea that these things were being provided. But they had some cigarettes in there, and they had some powdered milk, and there was a 10-pound package of food. And I used to remember everything that was in those things, but we had a pound of butter and a half a pound of sugar, some instant coffee, and of course I mentioned these cigarettes, and powdered milk, and biscuits of some sort, and some vitamin C pills, and usually a can of salmon or a can of tuna, and a pound of raisins or prunes or apricots. Quite a little bit of food, which was supposed to augment the diet, but all we got as a prisoner, we got a bowl of rutabaga soup each day, and we got four little thin slices of bread, and that was it from the Germans. And if it hadn't been for the little bit of food we got in the Red Cross parcels, boy, we would have really starved. We were supposed to get one of those parcels every week, but the best I ever got was one every 2 weeks, and usually it was about one a month. And of course, you know, things got stretched pretty thin by that time. Oh, I had an awful high fever, and I felt so bad for such a long time. But finally, after the Battle of the Bulge, they decided to move us out of there, and it was in February in 45. I had been, November, December, January, February, about 3 months in this hospital, and I had just barely started to hop across the room to the toilet, and the scar tissue was just starting to form around the edges of my wound. And they decided to transfer me out of there, so I didn't know where in the heck we were going. I had two guards with me, and I had to kind of hobble along to keep up with them. One was an old guy who had been wounded in World War I, and the other was a young kid, about 17 or 18. So we went down to the train station and got on the train and went for a ways, and we stopped at a place, and I thought we were probably going to pick up some food, but we didn't. I had no idea where they were going to take me, but it ended up being down in Frankfurt, Germany, and it took us 4 days to get down there. Well, not having any food, I happened to have 8 packages of cigarettes because I wasn't hardly able to smoke with all this high fever that I had. So I'd give this young kid a package of cigarettes, and when we'd stop, and boy, he'd disappear, and pretty soon he'd come back with some bread and some cheese and some bologna. By golly, we'd sit down and have us a little feast, you know, waiting for another train. Well, finally we arrived at Frankfurt, Germany, and boy, that was quite a nightmare getting down there. I had a hard time keeping up with those guys. But they were pretty nice to me, really, as best they could be. Well, let's see, I'm getting close to the end of this tape, so continue the story on the other side. I'll go ahead and let this tape run out. Okay, we're on the other side now. Well, when I got to Frankfurt, Germany there, this was an interrogation center, and I'm a son of a gun if they didn't put me in solitary confinement. And Oh, I was there, I don't know, I guess it was a day or two, I'm not sure. I lost track of time. But the door opened in this room, and a German soldier came in. He was a staff sergeant called Oberfeldwebel or something, I think. But he had a little clipboard with him, and he asked me my name, rank, and serial number. And I told him. And he said, well, he said, Lieutenant, he said, I can't tell you much about the war effort, but he said, I have some dreams, and he said, I can talk about these dreams. And I thought, oh, what in the heck is this guy talking about, you know? And he said, I dreamed that you were with the 306 Bomb Group, 423rd Squadron. You were stationed in Thurlow, England. Well, you know, that wouldn't be too hard to figure out. But then he went on and told me where I was born in Kansas, and when I went to high school, and when I graduated, and when I went into the Air Force, and oh, gee whiz, he just had quite a history on me. And he went on and on and on about it, you know, and I just sat there on his bed almost in shock. So after going through all of this, why, he folded up the little notebook, and he said he started to leave. And I said, you know, I said, you got some pretty damn good dreams. He just kind of smiled, you know, because he knew he had all this information. So as he started to leave, I said, wait a minute. I said, have you dreamed when the war is going to end? And he said, well, as a matter of fact, I have. He said, I dreamed it would be over in 90 days. Now, this was February the 12th in 45, and by golly, May the 8th, it was over. He missed it by 4 days. I thought that was pretty darn good. Those guys really had to know what was going on in order to interrogate intelligently. And, of course, there was no point in me asking who was going to win because we both knew. Well, from Frankfurt, I was transferred down to Nuremberg, which, that was pretty bad down there because this was still in the winter and got colder than the devil in Germany. And we were in these big old barracks, just bare barracks. We had to sleep right on the floor. Had two little bitty old thin blankets, and oh, boy, you talk about being cold and uncomfortable, you know, on a hard floor. Oh, that was pretty darn miserable. And we got two meals a day, two bowls of soup, and we just darn near starved at that place. I was so weak that I could hardly get up off the floor without almost blacking out. We had bed bugs and fleas and lice and, oh, gosh. But, you know, I never got bitten by any of them, and I often thought that probably it's because I smelled so bad, because I had two baths in the whole 6 months that I was a prisoner, and I'm sure I smelled pretty bad. It was, it was 3 months after I fell in this peat bog before I got my first bath. That was when I left Lingen in February. Finally, we were transferred out of Nuremberg after the front kept moving in, you know, the American Army. And we went down to Moosburg, which was about 30 miles northeast of Munich. Was on a train, and oh boy, I'll tell you, that we got bombed several times. And one place, we were at a little town called Ingolstadt, Germany, and this train stopped, and the heavy bombers came over and bombed this town, and we were out, I guess about a half a mile or mile from the center of town where they were bombing. Gee whiz, we saw the planes coming over, and the bombs dropping down and all the anti-aircraft fire and everything. We had pretty much a ringside seat. Oh, once I heard somebody said, hey, look, there's six P-51s. Well, our fighter planes, after the bombing raid, they would, the escorts, they would generally drop down and they'd just shoot up anything that they looked like a military target. Well, anyway, these planes went out of sight, you know, and we said, oh, give them hell, you know, and all that. So next time we saw them, they had circled around, and they came back, and by golly, they were shooting at us. I think that was the most frightened that I ever was during the whole war. You know, we couldn't get behind anything or even get under anything, and those bullets were, you know, flying over our heads. They shot up the engine, and fortunately the train crew had let the steam out of the engine so it didn't explode. But anyway, they shot the engine up, killed one of the train crew members, and hit one of our boys, hit him in the arm, and just tore the arm completely off. Oh boy, you talk about being mad. If any one of those planes had gone down and we could have got a hold of one of those fighter pilots, I think we'd have torn him to pieces right there. Well, they finally got another engine down there and hooked onto this train. And well, they had 30 of us in these little bitty old boxcars. And we'd been on there, I think, about 4 days on this train getting down there. Oh boy, I'll tell you, things got pretty goddamn grim, you know, at that time. And we were eating a little bit out of a Red Cross parcel that we had picked up when we left Nuremberg. And we finally got to Moosburg, and they put us in this compound there. Oh, guys, there were about 500 men, and we had one cold water tap. That was it. We were very close to the point of starvation. Actually, I think if the war had lasted maybe another month, I don't think I would have made it because I was getting down so low. Finally, on April 29th, one of General Patton's tanks rolled up in the middle of our compound, and all at once we were liberated. And by golly, by this time they had people from practically all over the world, because they were moving people back from the front. We had, of course, Americans, and actually had British and Australians and New Zealanders in there, and Canadians, and there were some from the Serbian army that had in there. There were two Brazilian pilots. There were some Hindus. I don't know where in the heck they came from, but it was just a mishmash of people from all over the goddamn world that had congregated here at this PW camp. A bunch of Russian prisoners in there, and oh boy, now the Germans treated those Russians pretty darn bad. They told us that they gave the Americans the best treatment because we treated their prisoners good. And then the British and the Canadians and Australians and everything on farther down the line. And of course the Russians were at the bottom of the list. I've seen them make them fight fires right out during a bomb raid, right out in the marshaling yards. Wouldn't let them go to the air raid shelter at all. Well, when this tank rolled up there and they took the German guards out and put American MPs up, and there were some SS troops which were in the guard, and we were in the furthest back compound. And I think there were about eight of these SS guards, which everybody hated them. They were a bunch of cruel SOBs. But they went out through a back gate, and there were about, 30 or 40 Russian prisoners that took after them. And finally, they got them kind of caught up with them out in a little wooded area. And they just beat and stoned and kicked and killed every darn one of them. They were pretty brutal. The MPs told us, if nobody leaves, we'll have you out of here, you know, in a short time. So we said, well, the hell with that noise. So me and two or three others went out the back gate there. Somebody had a wire cutter and cut a hole in this big fence that they had around us. So we went around raiding wine cellars and warehouses. I happened to liberate a German motorcycle, and me and another guy were going to go to Munich. And the war was still on. It wasn't quite over yet. So got this motorcycle that I had liberated, and I got some gasoline and one thing another from the American GIs. Went to a GI field kitchen, and oh golly, they gave me some food. And I ate it, and gee whiz, it was so rich that it made me sick. I threw up. I couldn't keep good solid food down. Oh, it was about 3 weeks before I could really keep rich food down, but it tasted good anyway. With this motorcycle, I'd go out to these field kitchens and I'd get a whole bunch of rations and I'd bring them back and I'd feed the rest of them in the compound. The Americans, they didn't have enough food, didn't give us as much food as the Germans did because they weren't prepared for all of that, all the prisoners. I don't know how many prisoners there were in there, but there were a heck of a lot of them. So I just go out and, several of the others, there were some that found some cars. One guy got a truck, and we were just going around raiding wine cellars and warehouses and tearing up any kind of a military stuff while we'd just destroyed, whether it was airplanes or what. And we milled around there for, I don't know, I guess about a week or so, and finally they were trying to get things organized and get us out of there. And they had flew some C-54s in the old twin-engine cargo plane and got us loaded on there. I was loaded in one of them. And they took us to Reims, France. And then we went on to Rouen. And then we went on to Cherbourg, I think. Well, by this time, my leg had started broken open and was getting bleeding pretty bad. So they took me back to a hospital in Paris, and I was there and just kind of laid around killing time. And of course they had me scheduled for air evacuation, and I thought, oh boy, I'll get the heck out of here one of these days. I found out later that my navigator, he hitched a ride back to England. And golly, he got his back pay, got his promotion and the whole thing, and he got back to the States before I did. But in this hospital there in Paris, couldn't get paid, you know, all that confusion and everything going on. So finally they came through, and one sergeant said, call my name, says, we're going to get you out of here. And I said, oh, air evac? He said, no, he said, are you ambulatory? Yeah. Well, I was classified as a litter case. And he said, we can only take ambulatory people. I said, listen, I can walk. So they scheduled me then as ambulatory. So I went to, I think it was Le Havre, France, and I got on a hospital ship. And we headed back across the Atlantic. Gee, I think there must have been 10,000 people on this ship. You know, there were ex-prisoners of war and everything you think of. But it was so loaded and so crowded that I think it was 5 days that we were on the seas. We got back to the United States the 5th of July. We pulled into New York Harbor there, and they were preparing to unload us. Well, gee whiz, there was a party boat that came out, and the harbor had a whole bunch of gals on it, you know, and they were waving at us and everything. And, everybody went over to the side of the ship there, you know, waving at the gals. And we ended up, it had a 13-degree list to the ship with all the weight on this one side, and they couldn't get the thing docked. So the captain said, now hear this, you know, everybody return to their quarters, you know. Well, of course, you can imagine what we told him. And nobody budged. So finally, the harbor master, he got another boat and got some gals on it, had them pull up on the other side of the ship, and so that about evened things up, and the ship got straightened out, and they were able to put us into the dock. Oh, what a relief it was. I don't think I relaxed until I finally planted my feet on the good old USA soil.